Hello, this is Sam Liebens from the University of Haifa, recording this for you in the rainy city of Leicester in England. We've got to an amazing place in the book of Shmuel Bet, in the 18th chapter, Perek Yudchet. I'll give a quick summary of the chapter before honing in on what I find to be a very captivating, if somewhat morbid, disturbing image at the heart of this chapter. David HaMelech has been offered an opportunity, basically, to regroup because Avshalom didn't take the advice of Achitophel to engage in a quick surgical strike as David HaMelech was fleeing from Yerushalayim. Instead, we're told because God intervened, Avshalom took the less good advice of Hushai. The advice was to mobilize the entire army, as many men as Avshalom could muster, which obviously was going to take more time than a quick surgical strike. And this gives David this opportunity. He does regroup. He sends out his soldiers in three groups, David HaMelech, under the command of Yoav, one group, under the command of Avishai, the brother of Yoav, the second group, and the third group, under the command of Ittai Agiti, Ittai the Gittite. And they urge David not to come with them, since the entire raison d'etre of Avshalom's campaign is to have David HaMelech killed. And since they're trying to defend David HaMelech's place on the throne, they think it would be counterproductive and also potentially very bad for morale if David HaMelech is exposed to danger. So they leave him behind and they go out and they fight this battle. And it's a massive victory for the soldiers of David HaMelech. The verse describes it as a magifah, as a plague, a great plague that was unleashed upon the enemies of David, the soldiers of Avshalom. 20,000 people die in just one day of battle. The scene of the battle is so extensive that it tells us, we're told that soldiers are dying in the forest, more than being consumed by the forest, more than they were being killed by other troops. The commentators discuss what this might mean, but it seems as if what's being described to us is a battle that's so geographically extensive that soldiers are finding themselves lost in the wilderness, trapped in places where they are exposed to the dangers of wildlife and wild beasts. And then Avshalom himself is riding his mule under this tree, under this terebinth tree. V'chazak rosho, his head gets stuck in the tree. Perhaps the pshat is that he bashes his head quite hard into this tangle of branches that's described in the verse, and he's left suspended in the tree, as perhaps unconscious, as his mule carries on trotting or galloping, and he's there suspended between, as the verse says, suspended between the heavens and the earth, as the mule carries on trotting on. And the translation that I have in front of me, in many Jewish translations, and indeed Rashi and the rabbis, say that it's not his head that gets stuck, and it's not that he was perhaps rendered unconscious, it's his hair that gets stuck. And he's left dangling by his hair. But if he's still conscious, you might worry, well, why didn't he just somehow cut himself free or call for help? Rashi addresses this question by citing a Gemara from Tractate Sota 10b, Daf Yud Amud Bet. Says that Avshalom was only stuck by his hair. His hair had got tangled in the tree. And he unsheathed his sword to cut himself free, but he looked down. And he saw the gawning jaws of hell open waiting for him to fall into them and be consumed. So in the rabbinic imagination, not only is he conscious, not only is he stuck not by his head but by his hair, but he's not hanging between heaven and earth, he's hanging between heaven and hell. This scene is reported to Yoav by a nameless soldier who didn't kill Avshalom in this state, because David had pleaded with his men to go gently on Avshalom. Certainly he wanted to have himself restored to the throne, but he didn't want his own son to be killed in what happened. But as soon as Yoav hears, Yoav, who we know to be something of a wild man, something of a, even one might say, bloodthirsty warrior, he, and whose hands are not completely clean in this particular story, because Yoav, as you will know from previous chapters, played a really crucial role in the attempted rehabilitation of Shalom, of Avshalom, inviting him back to Yerushalayim. Unbeknown to Yoav, this would result in this war, but perhaps Yoav feels a weight of responsibility for all that happened, and he goes off with his maybe a crack troop of his own men, and they beat Avshalom as he's hanging still alive on this tree until he dies. And then there's a perplexing story about Ahimaaz, the son of Tzadok, and a Cushi soldier, both running to tell David the news. Ahimaaz tells David that the battle has been won, but is unwilling to tell David that Avshalom had died. And he says, wait, there's another messenger coming, a messenger who Ahimaaz had overtaken on the way, this Cushi messenger who breaks the news to David that Avshalom has died. And therein ends the chapter. But I just want to return briefly to this image of Avshalom hanging from this tree. He's hanging by his hair, the rabbis imagine, for good reason, because we've had a description of Avshalom, a very vivid description of Avshalom as a very beautiful human being, without blemish from head to toe, and with this extraordinary luscious hair that weighed very heavily on his head that he would cut just once a year. So if he's going to be stuck in the tree by his head, it's no wonder that we might imagine that his hair was what was getting in the way. Now, this leads me to think a little bit about Avshalom. Avshalom showed tremendous promise. He was probably heir apparent and may have one day have succeeded David naturally to become king of Israel, son of the anointed. He had, we know, a keen sense of justice when Tamar was raped, Tamar, his sister, other people who were close to Tamar, like David, Tamar's own father, seemed to keep a deathly silence in the face of this horrible injustice and violence that had been done to her. But Avshalom had a sense of justice that burned within. Now, we might worry about the vigilantism that he had that led him extrajudicially to kill his brother Amnon, who had been the rapist in this horrific scene. But nonetheless, we see a man who, in the face of a quite unforgivable silence, was unwilling to overlook the great wrong that had been done to his sister. So we see a man who has the potential to be a future king, who is possessed of a spirit of justice, animated by a spirit of justice. And he also has these great kind of public political skills. He's beautiful, and he has this luscious hair. And when he comes into a public place, the Bible describes him as raising out his arm and bringing people in, kissing them and hugging them. I'm thinking of a polished political activist who goes into the marketplaces and kisses babies as he campaigns for his election to power. Those skills can seem like a certain type of sliminess, a kind of duplicity, a slickness, perhaps a superficialness, a certain superficiality that doesn't that where he shows one face of polished affection, but it doesn't really go very deep and he doesn't really mean it. On the other hand, those skills, the ability to relate to people, to speak in the language of people, are indispensable for real political leaders. And if they're used for the good, then those skills shouldn't be looked down upon. They're important and leaders need to have them. So here's a person with great potential, but it all goes terribly, terribly wrong because he uses these skills ultimately, not in order to further that sense of justice that he used to have in his earlier days, but in order to facilitate his own premature ascension to power. He seems to become power hungry to the extent that he's willing to kill his own father in order to satiate that hunger for personal success and power. And then that hair that was a symbol of his potential in a sense, but also a symbol of how everything went so wrong, is what makes him meet his comeuppance. I just want to share with you very briefly a passage from The Unbearable Lightness of Being by Milan Kundera, where he speaks about Stalin's son, Yakov, who, according to the slightly fictionalized account in the novel, was captured by the German troops in the Second World War and was in a prisoner of war camp with British soldiers. And Yakov, the son of Stalin, and these British soldiers would argue about the state of the latrine that they shared. And the British soldiers accused him of leaving a foul stench and a foul mess and ordering him to clean it up. And he refused to clean it up. And he went to speak to the German commander, and the German commander refused to be brought into such a trivial argument between these inmates. And Stalin's son could no longer take the humiliation, says Kundera, crying out to heaven. In the most terrifying of Russian curses, he took a running jump into the electrified barbed wire fence that surrounded the camp. He hit the target. His body, which would never again make a mess of the British's latrine, was pinned to the wire. Kundera imagines Yakov as a person who was used to bearing on his shoulders a drama of the highest order, because in the sense of being the son of one of the most powerful men on earth, he was like the son of God. But in the sense that his mother had probably been killed by Stalin, at least that's how Kundera understands it in the novel, he was also like a fallen angel, somebody who'd been rejected by God. And how could he, a person who's used to that tremendous drama on his shoulders, undergo judgment not for something sublime in the realm of God and the angels, but for his own excrement, for the mess he'd been leaving in a latrine? Says Kundera, with the very highest of drama and the very lowest so vertiginously close. And Kundera imagines as this corpse of Stalin's son is suspended mid-air on the electrified security fence around the prison, that he was lifted in defiance of gravity by the infinite lightness of a world that had lost its dimensions. You see, the Bible describes the human being in the Sefer Tehillim, in the Book of Psalms, Psalm 8. What is man that you have been mindful of him, mortal man that you have taken note of him? Ma'enosh kitiz karenu, ven adam kitiv kedenu. V'techasreihu ma'at me'elohim v'chavod v'hatar v'hadar titarehu, that you have made him little less than divine and adorned him with glory and majesty. On the one hand, you see a person like Avshalom, he's just a little lower than the angels. He's the son of the anointed king of Israel. But on the other hand, we're all just made from the dust of the earth, like Adam HaRishon, and to the dust of the earth we return. And Avshalom was caught in this drama between the great and sublime potential that he held upon his shoulders as the son of the anointed king of Israel, and a man with great, great potential, but also just a human being plagued by the vanities of humanity and by the base desires of humanity. And it's that tension, perhaps symbolized by his hair, that leaves him suspended, quite literally in the biblical text, between heaven and earth.